Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Give your walls the most advanced protection with Pittsburgh's Paramount Interior Paint and Primer in one. It's scuff, scrub, and wear resistant, while also blocking stains and delivering true one coat coverage. Choose from thousands of color options and refresh your space for spring. View our entire selection of paint and accessories today on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to find great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Hi, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for the wonderful charity Help Musicians. Joining me is a truly iconic musician who overcame a very difficult childhood, and he later survived a shocking crime to become an American punk pioneer and ultimately something of a Renaissance man. He sang for Black Flag, fronted his own band. He's also a spoken word performer, radio presenter, actor, voiceover artist, and a prolific writer. And he's best friends with William Shatner. He is, of course, the incredible Henry Rollins. Hey, Henry, welcome to the podcast I Never Thought It Would Happen.
No problem.
Which is for a British charity called Help Musicians. A very cool charity that helps musicians in all sorts of ways.
Oh, cool.
People with mental problems, people with financial problems, people in all sorts of difficulties. So how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
What do you like in your own company? Are you comfortable being on your own?
It's my preferable state. I live alone. I work alone. I live in a very small house at the end of a street. No neighbors to my left. And a neighbor way down the hill on my right who I've met. He's an architect. Nice guy. Uh-huh. I say hello to the people at the gym behind the counter, or I'm always polite to the person at the grocery store. Past that, I don't really interact much outside of business transactions. Like, you know, talking to the road manager or my manager. And I talk to my best friend every Sunday, who we've been best friends since we were 12. That would be Ian Mackay of the band Fugazi. It's amazing. It's amazing to have done one thing for that many decades. Yeah, past that, I am an extraordinarily solitary person the more and more the older I get.
When you're a kid, I don't know if you're like me, but my imagination was the safest place where I could be. You know, I didn't really want to be around anybody else. I just wanted to be in that strange world.
Yeah, I sought refuge in my room. I liked Beatles records. I considered them to be my four alt dads. Because, you know, they had fun songs. They seemed like they'd be friendly people. And because my home life, the reality of it was fairly terrifying. Like, you know, every third person you meet in the world, their childhood was crummy. And so my mom's boyfriends were abusive and perverted. My father was a fantastic homophobe, racist, misogynist professor. He's also a PhD. Like, he should know better. And he married he married a woman who hated kids. And her son was a pervert. And so everything sucked outside of the room. I was one of the only white kids at a school where a lot of black kids were like shipped in from their terrifying neighborhood. This is Washington, D.C. in the 1860s. And, you know, there's a lot of racism in those days. America, it's a rough room. And in those days, being a jittery little kid pre-Ritalin, the daily sojourn to school to be, you know, called cracker and, you know, have your lunch taken and, you know, everything sucked except for my room, my little record player, and what I could think of on my own. And so, I was kind of the on my own type from a very early age.
When did you find out that writing words would be a way of expressing maybe your feelings and your depression? Bringing it out for other people to hear?
Well, there's two answers. I learned that I was a depressed person very early on. Like, just like everything sucked. So I told my mother, like, I'm sad all the time. That's like my six-year-old articulation of it. And as soon as I was able to write, I still had depression. So I go, I'm sad all the time. She goes, well, and she whipped out one of her yellow legal pads of paper and her pencils. And she goes, write it out. Write out exactly what you're feeling. And it was really helpful. And it was like some 6-year-old, 8, 10-year-old scrawl, whatever. But it would take the internal and externalize it. She goes, now read it back. And like, it was unbelievably helpful. And in high school, I hated school. So I was on Ritalin. I didn't like it. They didn't like me. And I would write like these short stories. Well, you know, 2 pages of notebook paper about blowing up the school and killing the teachers. I would show this to the one sympathetic teacher I had at the school, Mr. Klinger, who taught English. And I had a 105 grade point average in English in high school. You know, read these books over the summer. Read them 2 years ago. No problem. Like, read all the Steinbeck books, Hemingway. I don't know how much I understood, but I reread them later. So English was easy. Math and everything else, I floundered. And so I would show Mr. Klinger my little essays. And he said, Henry, he no longer taught me. I was out of his class. He goes, feel free to always show me this stuff. Never show any of this stuff to your other teachers. You will get in trouble, but I'm glad you're writing creatively. And I hate to swell up, but I can't help it. Years and years later, you find out that I'm the celebrity of my old high school. Everyone knows who Henry is. And a guy wrote me, he goes, I'm years younger than you, but I had Mr. Klinger as an English teacher. And just so you know, he used your books in his classroom all the time. He talked about you and he would write your sentences on the chalkboard as an example of creative writing. And that knocked me out. He goes, he loved you. And I was never in touch with him after I graduated from high school. I've never gone back. I've been invited to speak there. I just put it behind me. I never liked it. And he eventually drank himself to death somewhere in the early 1990s, somewhere in there. Ian sent me the obituary.
It sounds like possibly one of the best awards you could ever get.
Yeah, I was buying slides and transparencies on eBay from a guy, and he wrote me. He goes, dude, I know who you are. I went to the same high school as you, and Mr. Klinger taught me. I'm like, whoa! And we went back and forth and talked about that through the eBay chat page or whatever. And he told me all of that. And that meant a lot to me, I must say. And I never had a chance to thank him. But that was pretty cool to find out.
Yeah, there always takes one teacher. I mean, all the teachers that I had weren't interested at all in any of the poetry that I would write. And then one day we had a stand-in English teacher who stood in for somebody who was ill. And he picked up on it and he said, have you listened to Dylan? I didn't know who Dylan was at the time. And he brought in a Bob Dylan record. And that kind of like opened my eyes that poetry could become songs.
Yeah. And so when did you start writing lyrics? Or to ask the question you asked me, when did you think that you could write to express yourself and for other people's benefit?
Very early on, I think when I've just been reading one of my diaries from 50 years ago, and I was writing poems all the time to express myself. But I think it was probably a few years before that, because I found my imagination a really safe place, as I said. And I think that warrants the ambition to write. And I think that's kind of what happens to people like you and I who go to a dark place to find the expression, the ambition.
Yeah, and by doing so, you light up the rooms for other people.
You do.
Yeah. As gnarly as some of the writing I've released, those are the books that I get the most response from. Henry, your book, the super angry whatever book, kept me from wanting to kill myself because I found someone as bent out of shape as me. And so I would encourage any person to never hurt themselves. And if, as Chuck D used to say, when I get mad, I put it down on the pad. Like if at all possible, externalize those feelings, you know, without harming someone. But like writing or, you know, drums or, you know, what running, like whatever it is. But the path of writing as expression, you know, all my big heroes, I have so many, the ones if I could be back in their time, who I'd want to meet. It wouldn't be John Coltrane, who I would love to meet. It would be like F. Scott Fitzgerald or Thomas Wolfe, Baudelaire, Rimbaud. You know, these are the people who blow my mind. Hendrix, certainly, but not as hard as Rimbaud, where I don't understand how you wrote that book, where I can kind of understand a blues progression. a bit more.
Sounds familiar. What would you have been playing on your record player to cheer you up?
My mom bought me Beatles records, and I had some of those dopey records they give for kids where you can kind of sing along, you know, Jimmy Crack Corn, or those ones where they have like an old radio show, like The Shadow or Fibber McGee and Molly or The Lone Ranger. They would make those like one LP length things for kids, like the kid who builds the rocket ship in his backyard. And there's songs. It's like a musical. Mm-hmm. I'm going to the moon tonight, all that stuff. I had the setting on the record player where you just hit the switch. It's like a $4 record player. It folds up into a suitcase thing you can carry around. That it would just repeat. It would get to the end of the record, and that loud mechanical sound would happen, and the arm would get racked back to the beginning, and it would just kind of thunk back on the beginning of the record. I would put the side of a record on for hours and just let the same five songs from the Yellow Submarine soundtrack album just play over and over again. And at one point, my mom bought me one of those single-speaker Norelco cassette players. And she bought me Abbey Road on cassette, which rapidly became my favorite Beatles record, which it still is. It's Ian's favorite Beatles record as well. We're huge Beatles fans. But I had like 10 records, and I, you know, was horrible to them. I destroyed them by never putting them back in their sleeves. It was punk rock that made me kind of an amateur audiophile, where I, you know, took care of my records because I was actually working for a living to buy them. But music was my refuge, and to my mother's credit, my mother had pitch-perfect taste in music. She rarely watched TV, only like the news. She had walls of books and records. And so and like she was kind of crazy and scary, but she would always have records on. And so as a little kid, I'm being exposed to Bartok and Stravinsky and Wagner and Beethoven and Chopin and Barbara Streisand and Glenn Campbell and Miles Davis and John Coltrane, who she used to go see as solo acts and when they used to play together, and Monk. And show tunes like Hello Dolly and Jesus Christ Superstar. And so I liked all of it. You know, I liked the Hair soundtrack as much as the Beatles record.
Yeah.
And it was all good to me. Barbara Streisand, I don't have any of those records now, but I would never put her down. She's amazing.
Yeah, really.
I was raised on kind of amazing, like Broadway stuff and. And living in Washington, D.C., everything comes to Washington. And so I saw, I'm trying to remember the man's name, the last tour of Men of La Mancha, the guy who made it famous. I'm sorry, his name is escaping me. My mom grabbed me by my ear and put me into her 1968 VW Fastback. We're going to go see Man of La Mancha because it's this insert name here. It's his last tour of doing it. I don't want to go. Get in the damn car. Of course, I loved it. We're going to the Kennedy Center because you're going to see Pearl Bailey do her last tour of Hello Dolly. I was 14. I wept watching that.
I bet.
When she comes onto the stage to do Hello Dolly, everyone in the audience knows what's coming. And unless you bought a ticket for the next night, you're never going to see her do this again. So roses are hitting the stage, long gloves as gifts. And my heart was pounding in my chest. And so as a young kid, I was, you know, very odd, but strangely eclectic because of my mother, as far as music and an appreciation for art, because she had a ton of art books. And it's Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian, all the different galleries are there.
Yeah.
And so I was dragged in front of all of that over and over. That was like a Saturday for my mom, was like making me go see the Rembrandt thing at the big building downtown.
So I guess that was the first gig you went to?
Yeah. Was seeing plays and musicals with my mom, Porgy and Bess, stuff like that. But she didn't take me to see Hair because there's nudity or whatever.
Of course, she went
multiple times. I don't know if you ever heard of the actor Emlyn Williams, I think his name was. He used to tour doing recitals of people's work. And he did Dylan Thomas. And he did it where he just has memorized like half of the damn canon of the guy's work. And he recites it on stage, very dramatic. And it was hysterical. Dylan Thomas, he's so funny. And these shows would happen at Ford's Theater. So you're sitting at Ford's Theater looking up and to your right to the the presidential box where Abraham Lincoln was shot in the back of his head. And stage left, your right as the audience, is where John Wilkes Booth landed, broke his leg, and ran out the back door up the alley, which was behind the old 930 Club in Washington, D.C.
Oh, we've all played there.
Right. It was a different building. You know, they moved many years ago. Yeah. But that skinny alley that you drove up, John Wilkes Booth with his broken leg either ran up it or was on horseback out of the back of that building.
And so that's a great story.
Yeah, that kind of immediate history was a big deal. But early gigs for me, before I figured out how to go to see arena rock, which was fun. Mm. So me and Ian going to see Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith and Van Halen and Ted Nugent. You know, just what's on the FM radio at the time.
Yeah,
my first gigs as a punter was going to see people like Pearl Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, top shelf. Really, really good.
That is amazing. So I wish my parents were interested in music like your mother was. So I had to discover all of that for myself, which was a lovely journey. And like you, I had a record collection that I just kept playing time and time again because it took me away from any of the sort of depression or troubles that I may have been having as a young teenager.
Right.
I found music like the safe well.
Absolutely. To this day, I'm almost 62, and I have walls of records. I buy them all the time. Rare ones.
You do?
Oh, yeah. It gets worse the older I get. I try and play 5 LPs a night just to keep up with all the incoming. There's a lot of good independent music these days. It's never been better, in my opinion. But I have multiple stereo systems, 2 really nice audiophile systems, which I try to be in front of on a nightly basis. I'll be there tonight later on.
Do you have a good music store that's close by?
Or
do you get it online these days?
I do a mixture of both. The pandemic kind of took record stores away from me for years. In Los Angeles, there's an amazing record store called Amoeba. It's like a Tesco, but with records and DVDs, et cetera, and a really knowledgeable staff. I would go every Friday around lunchtime or before when, you know, the normal people are in their cubicles. I could get in there without too much of a hassle. And I would go in every week, or I'd go in on a Saturday night, like half an hour before they'd close at 11, just so I could kind of get non-disturbed. And then, you know, the pandemic came and that closed. But I go on eBay and Omega and a lot of different auction sites and buy rare records and posters and set lists and all that crazy stuff you don't really need. But I do a lot of mail order with records. These days, Bandcamp, I buy directly from the bands or like a lot of small labels. I've always been all about trying to support the labels. I have a radio show. So I'm always looking for new music. It's like trying to keep a furnace lit only using bits of newspaper. You can do it, but you have to feed it. Like you can't take your eyes off it. And so I'm always looking for music.
And that's on KCRW.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's the big NPR, National Public Radio affiliate for Southern California, where I was trained to do radio in the 80s. I trained there. Yeah,
okay.
There's a woman, she's gone now. Her name was Deirdre O'Donohue, and she had an amazing show. She was beloved in Los Angeles. It was called Snap, and she played everything from the Beatles to Laurie Anderson. It was like super eclectic. And all these interesting people were friends of hers, like Eno and Fripp. And she had that show in Los Angeles, which is still around today. I think it's called Breakfast with the Beatles. She invented that. And it's a staple. I don't know what station it's on now. And so she'd get Christmas cards from George Harrison. And like whenever I'd be at her tiny apartment in Santa Monica and the phone would ring, I'd dive for it. Go like, "Dear O'Donohue's residence, how may I direct your call?" Just because it was always someone interesting. Like,
yeah, of course.
"This is John. Where's Deirdre?" "It's John Cale. Like, he's in town playing that night," and I'd be her plus one with her on her guest list. She taught me how to do radio at KCRW, and then in 2000, she passed away, and in 2009, they hire me, and I'm sitting in the exact same, on the exact same table I did when I was in Black Flag, learning to do a 15-minute block. Mm-hmm. And so it was the serendipitous aspect of that is never lost on me. And I've been there since 2009. When I was at a station called Indy 103 starting in 2004. Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols had a show. Dave Navarro of Jane's Addiction had a show. Rob Zombie. So it was too good to last, and they couldn't keep it funded, so it went away. I've had a radio show for many years.
I still listen to KCRW here because when I lived in Los Angeles for a brief time making a Squeeze record, I just found it so amazing, the Chris Doritos program that he used to host. You know, he'd introduce you to music that you just wouldn't expect.
Yeah, Chris and I are both on Saturday nights. I think he's 6 to 8. And then Jason Bentley, my old boss, is 8
Jason
to 10.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm 10 to midnight.
Yeah. Okay. So when punk came along, did that give you an outlet for your anger?
Yeah. I mean, before that, I would try to get my aggression or anger, young man's blues, out of me by listening to people like Ted Nugent. But because it's basically you have a headache, so you're trying to cure it with alcohol.
Yeah.
The intent is like relieve the pain, but you don't have the right stuff. And so Ted Nugent is singing about Great White Buffalo and like how great he is and, you know, whatever. And so it's loud. It's certainly aggressive, but it's not hitting the spot. And me and Ian MacKay, you know, we're record fans. Like we're going to record stores trying to like, where's our music? Mm. And like we're buying all kinds of records. Like maybe this will be our band. Nope. Yeah. And then suddenly your cool friend who, you know, gets all the cool imports. Everyone has, if they're lucky, they have that guy in the know. For me, it was a guy named Bert, Roberto Quiraz, a wonderful guy. Bert was, you know, the quiet, cool, shy kid who goes to the hip record store. He loaned me, you know, the first Clash album. He loaned me the first Ramones album. And he said, bring them back tomorrow and don't scratch them. And so I dragged him home and I put him on my mom's really nice KLH system because my record player destroyed records. And I listened to the first Clash album and I'm like, okay. And it was an import in those days. I couldn't find my own copy for months. Yeah. And I listened to the first Ramones album and I had to listen to it twice. I'm like, what are these guys doing?
Yeah.
I had ELO records, man. I had records where there's like 90 overdubs and everyone sings perfectly. I love those records. I still have them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you hear the Ramones, like, well, what are you trying to do? It didn't offend me, but I didn't understand it. Like, they kind of beat me up. And by the third time I put it on, I'm like, oh, these are my new alt dads. And I, with great regret, I gave Bert back his records. That kind of started me off. And I went to an all-boys prep school out in the suburbs, you know, military bent. So I'm, you know, wearing a dumb uniform, being told to shut up all the time. Ian went to public school. So he actually met girls and had more of a real socialization process. And so he's in school with really smart, happening, streetwise kids. I went to school with people like a Supreme Court justice or George W. Bush, like country club kids. And so Ian was picking up all kind of intel on Buzzcocks, Adverts, the Sex Pistols, like all these bands. And so he's getting records and we're borrowing records. And that music hit us like a train. On February 15, 1979, The Clash came to Washington, D.C. with Bo Diddley opening. I still have the flyer for the show. And it's no barricades. I'm used to seeing, you know, Led Zeppelin with 20,000 other mooks at the Ontario Theater. You can walk down to the front and put your elbows on the stage and feel music, like going to a club. But I was like underage. It was a revelation to stand in front of Joe Strummer and watch all this heat come off this band. Mm. It was white phosphorescent heat. I've never seen anything like it. Bo Diddley was cool, but The Clash, they knocked me out. And of course, in those days, none of us have cars. So we have to walk home in our stupid punk attire through the park with snow on the ground, like a little line of young men with dippity-doo in their hair, like which is now freezing to your skull. And from then on, we became hipped to the club scene in Washington, D.C. And suddenly you're standing with 125 people getting Lux Interior of the Cramps off you because he'd be down to his underwear within three songs and rolling on the tops of the audience. And then Dee Dee Ramone is sweating on you at a Ramones gig. Like, I've never recovered from being at the front or carrying in the gear with the Bad Brains because you see them unloading their gear from their cars. Like, you guys need a hand? Yeah, and suddenly you're friends with the Bad Brains. And being Ian MacKay's friend, I watched him build Discord Records, you know, which has Minor Threat and Fugazi and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got into the independent music punk rock world like I jumped into the deep end and just, you know, didn't try and surface.
My name is Stuart Bailey. I live in Belfast, and I'm the editor of a magazine called Dig With It. We cover music and arts and counterculture in the north of Ireland. I've been a music journalist since 1985. I was assistant editor of the NME during the very exciting times of Britpop, Acid House and Manchester and lots of other things. I've written a few books. One of these is called Trouble Songs. It's a journey into the conflict in Northern Ireland and how songwriters responded to that, be it Paul McCartney and John Lennon, Elvis Costello and Kate Bush, and Irish writers like Dolores O'Riordan, Bono and Christy Moore. What motivates me is the idea that a great song can create change in the world. It can carry an idea or a sentiment, and it can put people onto the street, and it can save your soul. I grew up in the punk era of Belfast. We lost around 3,600 people during the conflict. But music, it helped to break down religious bigotry and sectarianism, and that's why it was important. When we met in punk clubs like the Harp Bar, nobody cared if you were Catholic or Protestant. It mattered more if you liked the Clash or the Buzzcocks, if you had broken free from all of those oppressive ideas. I saw the Clash at the Ulster Hall in Belfast in 1978. I took a day off school and I hung out at the venue beforehand, and I helped them move their gear in to the venue, and I watched the sound check, and then I walked around town with the band. They were interested in our lives, which was amazing, and they filled their heads with ideas. It was like getting a set of instructions for how to be self-aware and how to be alert and to question everything. What a great legacy. We had a great little band in Belfast called Stiff Little Fingers, and they wrote an amazing song called Alternative Ulster. The punchline was, alter your native land. And that's the kind of thing that we still work towards. The peace process in Northern Ireland is in a difficult place, but bless music, because it's played such an important role during the conflict. 25 years ago, we had the Good Friday Agreement, a potential peace plan, and it was going to a public vote, and everyone was confused. But the musicians came on board, and there was a gig at the Waterfront Hall with the band Ash from Downpatrick and U2 from Dublin down the road. I was the MC for the gig, and it was such a beautiful occasion. Music gave a voice to our best aspirations, and it swung the vote by 3%. Rock and roll saved the day. We have a great music community here, and we continue to strive for civil rights and an inclusive, diverse world. Between 2006 and 2016, I worked hard to co-found and develop a music hub in Belfast. We called it Oh Yeah, after a song by the band Ash. We turned a big whiskey warehouse into a building with a recording studio, a venue, an exhibition and rehearsal rooms. We're very grateful to organisations like Help Musicians who saw the worth in our vision and they helped us to get there. Having spent 10 years running a music venue, I know all about the terrible pressures that venues experience. I've seen great venues and community spaces disappear from Belfast, like the War Zone and the 343, the Menagerie and the Rotterdam. Our venues are constantly threatened by gentrification and by bad civic planning and the awful behaviour of property developers. Creative people are being pushed out of the city, and for working class artists, the prospects are especially tough. It's becoming a very unforgiving city. Happily, Help Musicians Northern Ireland, they were a massive source of strength and support during the pandemic, and the good work continues. More than ever, our musicians need support. Mental health is a massive issue over here. More people have died from suicide in the past 25 years than the fatalities that we endured during the conflict. Some great musicians are amongst those awful statistics. So, community support and outside help is critical for us, and organisations like Help Musicians are absolutely part of that, as we steadily but painfully work our way towards an alternative Ulster. It's what we need.
Music Music Minds Matter from Help Musicians is available 24/7 to anyone who works in music. Call us for free to speak to an accredited counselor who can offer you emotional support, advice, and information. It doesn't have to be a crisis or even about music. If you work in music and are struggling to cope, then Music Minds Matter is here for you. Simply call 0808 802 8008 or visit musicmindsmatter.org.uk to receive support today.
Where do you think music culture's gone?
Well, you know, you're asking me, so you're going to get only my opinion. I think as far as the music in my wheelhouse that concerns me, I think it's gone to a very good place in that you have a lot of musicians who are now, quote, owner-operators. John Dwyer of the band The OCs, great Los Angeles-based independent band. John owns his own studio. John owns his own record label. John is frighteningly prolific, and I don't think he's ever done a bad record. I'm such a fan. And live, that band is like getting run over. He's got two drummers. It's so good. And John, he writes it. He's got these crack musicians with him, and he just does it. He doesn't wait for your approval or a record label to say, go ahead, here's your budget. He just does the damn thing. And that would be DIY. That's Ian MacKaye. Yeah. That's SST Records, Black Flag, the label I was associated with for years. That's all my little labels. I've got five different things happening. I'm all kinds of incorporated. It's not waiting around. And people like Ty Siegel, great Southern California musician, own studio, own record label, produces not only his records, but records for other people. And so these young, amazing musicians are no longer waiting for the go-ahead from labels that are cool like Matador and Ipecac or Discord. They're doing their own thing. Hmm. And they're not aspiring to, we're going to get on the radio. We want to be on the Grammys. They don't care. Hmm. And they're doing music for the sake of music. And, you know, do they have an audience? So loyal, because people understand this is real. This is not showbiz. And these are bands that, like, sleep on people's floors. There's, like, a lot of noise bands, which I pay a lot of attention to. They do entire tours of house parties. They play basements where people stand around, smoke marijuana, drink beer in a freezing basement, and watch three maniacs murder laptops and pedals making noise. And that's the tour. They might get a few normal venues, but mainly it's like the underground. And they have their own labels, too. And they're making CDRs all spray painted. And I mail order all that stuff. And I'm quite a fan of where independent music is now. Basically, they treat an established independent label like Alternative Tentacles, Jello Biafra's very excellent label. They treat that label like it's Elektra or Warner Brothers. Like, that's the man. We don't want any part of it.
Sure.
I love that, where I love going to gigs, and it happens all the time. I'm the oldest person at the show. I'm older than the owner of the venue because he's a young 30-something, you know, visionary entrepreneur, whippersnapper. And I always stand at the back so no one, like, runs into me and breaks my pelvis. And so, you know, I can't be younger.
What would it be like if you were in a room with someone like Taylor Swift? Would you be able to write a song with someone like that?
Quite honestly, I've heard about half of a Taylor Swift song. My road crew, my merch guy, he's like has actually done merch for her and is a huge fan. I've been by her place, her compound. I've never been in, but I've been near it because our bus had to get repaired years ago. And I go, what's that over there? That's Taylor Swift's compound. Whoa. So she's got her own studio. Like, she's doing her own thing. So you're not telling her what time it is. I don't know her music, but to answer your question more to the point, I am not really into collaboration.
You're not? Okay.
No, when I was young, you know, you have to understand, I made music, a lot of it, for many years, kind of nonstop. And then I stopped, and I never went back. Like, I get asked to be on people's records. Hey, we're coming to town. Come and sing with us. No, thank you.
Wow.
Like, the last time I did it was many years ago, because I can't say no to Jay Maskus of Dinosaur Jr. So I sang a Dinosaur Jr. song on stage. But I've been asked by, since they're not here to defend themselves, some really amazing people said, hey, let's make a record together. like musicians I have traveled hours to go see one show of, they've said, hey, you and me, let's get together and do a thing. And I politely decline.
So when did that penny drop and why?
I was alone in bed, big surprise, in, I don't know, the early 2000s, like 2003 or four. I sat up in bed and I went, I'm done writing lyrics.
Wow.
And if I can't write a new song, I don't want to do old songs over and over.
Mm.
That's just wasting time, in my opinion. If someone else wants to do it, that's up to them. I thought it over. I'm like, wow, okay, yeah. And so I called my manager, I said, at the time, and I said, hey, I'm done being in a band. For me, I'm just like, I'm out. For him, that's like no more 10% of that particular action, which was quite
mortified.
It was pretty good for him at that point. The band was very successful fiscally. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what? Like, he flipped. He goes, no, we'll do a greatest hits tour. I said, Richard, people like me don't have greatest hits. I had a novelty breakout single song that we wrote in 5 minutes and has taken a lifetime to live down that Beavis and Butthead liked. Past that, I'm a club guy grinding it out, and I'm done. He said, well, think it over. I said, I have thought it over, man. But luckily for me, being the kind of workaholic jackass of all tirades type, I was already doing a lot of film and TV, lots of voiceover for commercials, documentaries, and animation, the talking tours, do like 20-some countries per tour, the book company. I was already super busy. So I just let those things kind of fill in the deficit not doing music created. And I call my bandmates, really good, hardworking lads. I said, fellas, we are like Thor Heyerdahl hauling Kon-Tiki to the sea. We're done. And luckily, they're all really good musicians, and they found homes in other bands.
Yeah.
The guitar player, you know, he writes songs for all kinds of famous people, and he's in a very famous country western woman's band right now. He's Daniel Lanois's bass player when he's not playing guitar in other bands. He was already doing that, so he didn't need me dragging him through, you know, tiny clubs in Italy. And so they all found homes, and I just moved on. And I used to be in airports all the time, and I'd see some band with their laminates and their road cases dragging their sorry asses to the check-in. I'm like, nope, I don't miss it. Don't miss it. I like touring, but I don't miss being in a band. I don't miss the democracy of it.
Wow,
and like, okay, let's hear what the drummer has to say. But I believed in all of that. Like, if we're going to write a song, then we all have to... You know, even though it would be like me and the guitar player, me and the bass player principally writing the song, we would always split the publishing up until my last lineup where I went, no, I'm not doing that anymore. But I always went at it from a very egalitarian point of view, which was not always to my liking because, you know, someone in the band's a pain in the ass and you have to listen to him when you can't strangle him. That's illegal. And so I don't miss... 14 people in a bus or like 8 people smashed into a box truck, you know, coughing up to whales. None of that. I don't miss any of that.
Did you think it was going to be a risk or were you confident you were going to get voiceover work and write books?
I said, as Iggy Pop says, I put on my heels and go to the disco and see who wants to dance with me.
I
say yes.
That.
Yeah. A variation of that is in his New York Times interview. Because they asked him, how'd you get involved with the people on your new record? He goes, they asked me. But many years ago, I was asked to do a voiceover for The Gap, the clothing store.
Yeah.
And I went, what's a voiceover? Well, you've seen an ad. There's a guy talking. We want you to be the voice. Well, I got a voice. And so I went to the studio. I read the copy. They hired me. They actually, you're not going to believe this. They pay. It's unbelievable. And I could help to pay my rent, which was always a struggle. And then that led me to getting an agent. And I was at William Morris. And then I'm the voice of Life Serial for 7 years. I'm voicing documentary for History Channel, Smithsonian, VH1, MTV. I'm the voice of Infinity Car for 5 years. I've done voice work on every iteration of Batman for Warner Brothers, usually a bad guy. I'm in animation projects I can't even tell you about because
that's amazing.
I've signed the thing where I can't talk about it until it comes out. Because this vocal booth I'm sitting in, I've actually done lots of voiceovers for Netflix and Nickelodeon. The engineers love this box. They think it sounds great.
It does and sound great, actually.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's good carpenters. I'm just sitting in it. But I said yes to work. And many years ago, when I was starving in a small house in Silver Lake, California, east of Hollywood, Crispin Glover was over at my place working on a book with my roommate, who's a small publisher. And he said, Henry, Hollywood's going to come looking for you. I want you to consider acting. I said, what do you mean? He's like, Henry, you have naturally what we go to class to try and learn. I go, what's that? He goes, you're crazy. And I said, well, that's a very thank you for your confidence, Crispin. I don't think any movie is going to come looking for me. Like 6 months later, I was in a UCLA student film. And a year after that, I'm chasing Charlie Sheen down some highway in the movie called The Chase. And then after that, I'm getting slapped around by Al Pacino in Heat, directed by David Lynch, and on and on and on. And then I had my own TV shows like History Channel, Independent Film Channel, National Geographic, and written screenplays that, you know, turned into films. And so I just said yes to stuff because you have to remember, I come from the minimum wage working world. I'm a high school graduate. I'm not that smart. I'm just desperate to do stuff every day.
Yeah,
I don't have any.
Same boat there.
Yeah, I have no confidence. I don't think I can do any of this stuff. I have fear of failure.
Yeah.
And so I come from a fighting posture, not, hey, I got this. I've never thought I got anything in my life, but I will die trying.
Yeah,
and so I'd rather have desperation than confidence. With confidence, you'll never see the truck that's going to run you over. If you're desperate, you're looking everywhere, trying not to screw up.
Do you ever find time to give therapy to people?
Hopefully, no. I mean, that
I think
means
you should.
I mean, that means human interaction. No, I mean, I tell stories from my life on stage, and like,
which
hey,
is therapy in itself.
Yeah, well, yeah, in a way, like it took me 3 years, but I finally got a visa and I went to North Korea. What? Yeah, I did, and so I'll tell that story. And like, I'm a nobody from nowhere. And so here I am in this film, dot, dot, dot. And I tell the story or I write about it. You know, I've written for, you know, everything from Rolling Stone to the LA Times. You know, when I'm in a country, sometimes they'll say, hey, do an op-ed for the Herald or whatever. I'm like, okay. And so I'll, you know, cough out like 1,500 words and they give you a donut and a slap on the back of the head. And so I've done a lot of like journalistic writing, won awards for it, believe it or not. And so maybe in those essays or, you know, 1,200 words a week for the LA Weekly I did for years, there was some kind of therapy in that.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'm the one who should be handing out advice because just between you and me and whoever listens to your podcast, I'm a wreck. And so I really have no plan. So
yeah, but most therapists are wrecks as well. They kind of hide behind the silence.
I've dated them. Yes, I know.
Yeah, you know.
And so the therapists I've dated, guess what? They are therapists.
They have therapists.
Because of the incoming trauma they have to help people with.
They have supervisors.
Oh, man. I wouldn't touch that job with a 10-foot pole. But I've been through some really unpleasant things in my life, and I've talked about them and written about them.
Have you written about Joe at all?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, like a whole bunch, because that stirred up a whole lot. And for your listener and viewers, that would be a guy named Joe Cole, who was murdered right next to me many years ago. And the guy shot at me a couple of times but missed, but he sadly didn't miss Joe. And so that was where a thing like PTSD comes from. You know, that's a happy hunting ground for PTSD. And I talked about that on stage. That's even been made into a DVD. Like it was just the material from a particular tour that got filmed, written about it. I just put out a book called Sick, S-I-C, you know, thus. And there's quite a bit about processing over decades all of that and what grief puts you through and what you think about, you know, gun violence in the United States and people who are kind of ushered into a life of crime in this country, which some people don't think is true. I think it absolutely happens in this country that some people are destined to perpetrate. It's where they're basically aimed. And there's a lot of work that goes into that because there's a lot of money in keeping prisons full.
Is there really? Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah, of course. It's the prison industrial complex. America's revenue streams is incarceration and conflict. Yeah. If we're not making you a weapon, we're pushing around some government and throwing some mud so they'll go attack so we can sell them some munitions. And then we'll come in and rebuild your country after we've bombed it. And we'll make sure the build is bad so we can come in and rebuild it a few more years later. Ask Dick Cheney all about it. But a lot of my writing, especially in the books, can be really intense. Mm. And I've published a lot of that. I own the book publishing company, so I sleep with the owner every night. I'm groping him now. And so they've been very confessional. And Hubert Selby Jr., the guy who wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn, he was one of the only friends I've ever had. And he always taught me to get out of the way of the truth and serve it. So if you have something really intense to say, mm-hmm. just say the damn thing. Don't make yourself look good. If you're not good, just tell the truth.
Yeah.
He's always on my shoulder when I write that kind of stuff.
That's amazing. Well, Henry, thank you so much for your time. You're a real survivor and a huge inspiration. And I would pay you $120 an hour to get some therapy from you.
Well,
if that ever were the case.
Well, you got this hour for free. But may I say, Chris, I'm not an expert on your catalog, but I have heard pretty much all of your recorded works, unless there's like some cool collector B-side I'm not aware of or appeal session. I mean, every band has stuff like that. But I'm quite well aware of you as a musician and a player and a lyricist. And I must say, well, you don't need anything from me, but I think you're really, really great. And that's been something I've thought for many, many years. And so, not only were you good, but the people you play with, just really great crack musicians. I was watching, thank goodness for YouTube, there's lots of live stuff.
Yeah, there is.
And very well recorded, like, you know, TV shows and like where everything is mic'd and mixed. And wow, you know, with that kind of mixing, you can't hide. Like everything is really naked.
Yeah.
And I know when a band has chops, and I like a studio band, you know, but there's a second take available. Mm-hmm. Live, you're flying Wallenda. There's no net. And I admire bands who can really do it live. And I watched, kind of preparing to meet you through a computer, I watched a bit of live stuff of you. And sadly, I've never seen you perform. I'm sorry about that. To my knowledge, I don't know if I've ever been on a night off or anywhere geographically convenient to be in a building with you. Mm. Being kind of a road dog, I miss out on a lot because I am the show at night. But it was really cool to meet you because it's like you don't need another fan. But I quite admire and respect what you've done.
Thank you so much. And God bless you. Thank you for your time. And, you know, it's incredible when paths cross. And at the beginning of the interview, you mentioned John Cale and he produced our first album. And that kind of ties everything up for me.
Yeah. And I met him once and he brusquely shook my hand. I said, "We're both playing on this festival." And he bellowed, "I know," and slammed the door. You were on Deptford Fun City Records 128 years ago.
Correct.
Yeah. That was first 7-inch.
Yeah, that was started by us and Miles Copeland.
Miles Copeland,
because we couldn't get a record deal, so we just formed our own label. And then A&M came along, and they signed us and the Sex Pistols, and they dropped the Sex Pistols.
And kept you?
Kept us.
And so you're on the same label as Mark Perry of Alternative TV.
Yeah.
Oh, he always writes me back whenever I write him. I have all his records. Oh, I think he was...
he's amazing. Yeah.
He's amazing. And I have all the Sniffin' Glue mags and all his records. And I write him like every, you know, few years about to ask him some fanboy question. And he always seems angry, but he always writes me back. It's like I'm bothering him or something, which is probably the case.
Oh, well, I hope we can keep in touch. That would be nice.
You know, it's good to meet you. And I hope our paths cross again.
They will. God bless.
Okay. Take care.
Bye. He's a truly fascinating and inspiring man, is Henry. an absolute powerhouse of creativity, and the determination to overcome whatever life throws at him. And also proof that you can work through life's problems and overcome them through art and endeavor. He's also that curio, a musician who walked away from his career at the peak of his powers. Something to think about. As always, thank you for listening and please subscribe to this podcast. Supporting Help Musicians in any way at all helps the musicians who bring so much to our lives. To find out more about Help Musicians, you can find them on all social media channels. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.